Welcome to the premiere episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. I'm bringing on Tom Haberstroh as my first guest to discuss Cats Knicks debut, NBA contenders, Ja Morant's ankle injury on Monday night, and I've got a bunch of questions for him about what could be a crazy NBA season. All that next. Welcome to the very first episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show, twice per week, every Tuesday and Friday. I'll be talking NBA with guests from all over the basketball world. I want this show to be informative, entertaining, and interactive. So I'm counting on you, the listener, to get involved too. Every single week, I'll be selecting the best fan questions and comments for our mailbag segment. You can submit those entries via email at kocshow@yahoosports.com. And I encourage you to send videos or audio notes because we're going to be doing this show on video every single week, but written emails and comments will work too. Again, that email is kocshow@yahoosports.com. Later on, I'll be sharing some thank yous and thoughts on my transition to Yahoo Sports. But right now, let's go. Let's get things started with my very first guest who will be joining me weekly all season long. It's Yahoo Sports contributor Tom Haberstroh. Tom, how you doing, man?
I am pumped and jacked to be here, KOC. Ready to rock, man.
I'm excited to have you, Tom, man. I am also pumped and jacked. I love the phrasing. We're recording this Monday night. It's 8:07 p.m. Eastern. Let's knock out the headlines on Sunday. Karl Anthony Towns and Mikal Bridges made their Knicks preseason debuts. Cat didn't have a great game. He had only 10 points on 7 shots, made only 1 of 5 threes. But I feel like his impact on the Knicks offense was pretty clear right out of the gates, Tom. I think we saw a lot of the same things that he did in the past. They're going to have him facilitate from the elbows like Hartenstein did for the Knicks. He's going to attack in space off the dribble from the perimeter like Randall did for the Knicks. But unlike the both of them, Cat shooting, that's going to be creating massive attacking lanes for Jalen Brunson. I think when you talk about shooting, it's the shooters amplify the talents of the stars on the team. And Cat, with his shooting and the spacing, is going to amplify the talents of Brunson. And obviously it's early, but the variety of offensive tacks we saw from the Knicks in the preseason opener and the way we can envision things moving forward, they were number 7 in offensive rating last year. I'd expect that to rise. Is it too bullish to say that the Knicks offense could go all the way up to number 1?
I don't think so. I think that's definitely within the realm of possibility because as we saw with the Boston Celtics offense last year, when you have a 5-out system and the Knicks are truly going to have a 5-out system, that doesn't just mean like some abstract thing that sounds cool and like it's something that is in vogue in the NBA. This actually helps Jalen Brunson get open passing lanes, driving lanes, and have more space to operate. So if you look at the Knicks, what they did against the Charlotte Hornets, and I unfortunately, even though they were in my backyard, I wasn't in town to go watch that game in person. But what I did see is Karl Anthony Towns, like you said, mixing and matching between, you know, being in that low hub, you know, operating as a passer in ways that I think we were a little surprised to see because, you know, Hartenstein was unbelievable as that hub, as a guy who was going to be able to run offense with his excellent passing. Karl Anthony Towns showed a little bit of it, the passing and the distribution and the amplifying with the pass. You know, there were a couple times where OG Anunoby or Mikal Bridges missed a layup that he would have gotten an assist for. But Karl Anthony Towns, what you're going to see from him this year is spacing the floor. And I think that's going to do so much for Mikal Bridges and the cutting, Jalen Brunson and the attacking. It's going to make everybody better offensively, I think. And really, what I want Karl Anthony Towns to do, Kevin, is just to sit down and watch Chris Bosh tape from 2013. Because Chris Bosh was similarly skilled as Karl Anthony Towns. A lot of hype, was a 20-10 guy over in Toronto, and then came over with the Miami Heat and had to sacrifice a lot of touches offensively. But in 2013, I guess at the end of 2012, when he became, you know, the pace and space stretch 5 next to Kendrick Perkins again in the OKC finals in 2012. From then on, like Karl Anthony Towns should be Chris Bosh, is locked down defensively, move around and be able to be that pick and roll defender and shot blocker, but doesn't have to be like 5 blocks a game. He doesn't have to be Kentucky Karl Anthony Towns, but he has to be smart, play within himself, and man, hit every shot down the floor. I mean, he is going to be a guy that I think could be the Chris Bosh of this New York Knicks team. And that's not a knock. I think Chris Bosh was one of the most underrated players of the last two decades in the NBA. And I think Karl-Anthony Towns has the right disposition, the right skill set, and I think the right coach. You know, Eric Spoelstra, Tom Thibodeau, known for their defensive aptitude. And I think he's in a great situation to be the Chris Bosh of this team.
It's a great call mentioning Chris Bosh, and it reminds me of I saw Todd Whitehead, who works for Sports Radar, and he posted this great graphic the other day on social media. It had the top 12 shooting bigs of the last 14 years since 2010. And it used a synergy metric, how they calculated it. The top 12 shooters and the top six were Dirk, Jokic, Kat, Bosh, Horford, and Porzingis. Everybody there besides Kat has won a title. And then the bottom six, it's more role players. Channing Frye, LaMarcus Aldridge, Bobby Portis, Serge Ibaka, Marc Gasol, Maurice Spates. All of them, except for Aldridge, have won a championship. So the formula in this new era, really ever since, like you said, the Heat moved Chris Bosh to the five and really changed everything that year. A lot of the formula is to have a big who can space the floor and shoot threes and play competent defense, whether it's Jokic, the way he's improved, the way, you know, Porzingis was able to make an impact for Boston, or some of the role players, Ibaka, and with Toronto as well with his size. So I think for New York, yes, Kat needs to be competent defensively. They used him in drop coverage. I thought he looked good. I know Kat at the five did not work in the past for Minnesota, but he also has never had Mikal Bridges or OG Anunoby or Josh Hart flanking him. Like, it's a dramatic difference when you assess Kat at the five when you get those guys.
Yeah, when you look at Chris Bosh, would you have ever imagined that in an NBA championship caliber team that he could be the anchor of a number eight defense in the NBA? No one had ever thought that. With the Raptors, they were 30th, dead last in defensive rating before he went to the Miami Heat. And if you had told me 2 years later he's going to win a championship at the five, people would have thought that was nuts. But I do think that, you know, this New York Knicks team really has an opportunity to, you know, yes, get better offensively, but maintain defensively, right? Top 10 defense, number of, you know, I think one is a stretch, but I think it's within the realm of possibility, like you said. But I really think that the Knicks, they haven't had this kind of presence offensively. When was the last time they had a stretch five? Like, think about it. When was the last time they had... It's Kristaps Porzingis. It's like literally since the Porzingis era.
There's really nobody since then. Like, Randall shot threes, but Randall has never shot over 35% from three all but one time in his entire career.
Right, and a full-time five, like maybe he played some at the five, but in terms of full-time five, Luke Kornet, back when he was with the Knicks. It's been a while, Kevin, since we've seen the Knicks have this kind of skill set at the five. And I got to say, I was a little like ho-hum getting into the NBA this season, just like the storylines. But once that Kat trade went down, I was locked in. I'm so excited to watch to see how this plays out, because it does feel like Karl-Anthony Towns in New York with Tom Thibodeau. This can go in a lot of different directions, but I'm actually warmer on the idea than a lot of my peers.
Well, and you mentioned the last time the Knicks had a stretch five. The last time Brunson had bigs that could effectively space the floor was when he was in Dallas. And you look at his numbers, I pulled them up earlier today. Brunson with Kleba or Porzingis, I know Kleba is more of a forward, but he plays some power forward for Dallas still to this day. But with Kleba and Porzingis, the Mavs offense scored 1.1 points per pick and pop when Brunson was the ball handler. Randall popped for Brunson last season, but again, he did not shoot effectively. He's only had one season in his career above 35% from three, whereas Towns is nearly 40% in his entire career. So I think this Knicks offense has a lot more layers to it, a lot more ways that it can play. If Mitchell Robinson's able to be healthy, or if they can flip him for another center, then you can play with two bigs and you can put Kat at the four. But a lot of the time it's going to be Kat out there at the five with a bunch of versatility and Brunson as the center of that solar system. The other side of that with the Wolves, I haven't had a chance to talk about this or write about it. I've been in hiding, but I'm back. I want to talk about the Wolves side of this trade. Tom, I my first impression of this was, man, Gobert Randall could be kind of clunky, but
yep.
I've had a lot of time to think about it since then. And like, a lot of people have talked about the Randall Gobert front court and how that may not work if Randall's not shooting threes. People have talked about, and rightfully so, avoiding the second apron penalties for Minnesota. I get that. But to me, this decision to trade Kat is a continuation of their entire offseason. They took a huge swing on draft night, trading two future firsts to move up and go get Rob Dillingham. They took an upside pick in the late first round to get Terrence Shannon. And now by trading Kat, they're betting on the guy they already have. That's Naz Reid. I've heard the Wolves internally think the gap between Kat and Naz Reid isn't that significant at all, if there's any gap at all. So if they can get 90% of Kat's production out of Naz Reid, who makes a fraction of the money, who's 4 years younger, and then Julius Randle can add a whole new layer, and then Dante DiVincenzo can bring much needed shooting and some ball handling too, it's very possible that Minnesota can end up way better in this trade with way different styles of play. What do you think about that, Tom?
I think what you're getting at, and maybe this is too strong of a take, I want to see Naz Reid at the four. I want to see more spacing. I want to see him next to Gobert. And I wouldn't mind, I know this is kind of crazy to say, but bring Julius Randle off the bench with Dante DiVincenzo. I love the look of Naz Reid. Like, stretch the floor, show that Naz Reid can't. I mean, this team was 14-6 without Karl-Anthony Towns last year in the regular season. And you saw in the postseason, Naz Reid could play in those big time moments. So Naz Reid, to me, is, you know, going into last year, was one of the most underrated players in the NBA. Then you put him in and slot him next to Rudy Gobert, where you get 40% three-point shooting. And something you said earlier and I wanted to hit on is, it's not so much the shooting percentages, it's what the defense respects you at. And to me, the defense knows that Naz Reid can shoot, and you got to go out and help on that shooter in a pick and pop situation or when he's in the corner. They can't shade off of him. Julius Randle, I think they're not screaming, shooter, 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 when he's out on the floor, in the same way that you do with Naz, same thing you do with Kat. And so I think Naz Reid, in terms of how clunky that offense can look with Julius Randle and Rudy Gobert, I think there is potential this season for us to look at the Minnesota Timberwolves and wonder, you know, should they just start Naz Reid at the four next to Rudy Gobert and make Julius Randle into that sixth man of the year candidate? I don't think he's going to like that, Julius Randle going into a contract here, but I do think that might be the best for the Minnesota Timberwolves.
It's absolutely best for the Minnesota Timberwolves. It's a matter of, will Julius Randle accept that without pouting and crying about it? That's the only question.
And that's
there.
My problem with the trade. That's my problem with the trade.
Sure. Absolutely. And if that means Chris Finch needs to start Julius Randle to keep him smiling, but that means he's not always going to be finishing games, then so be it. Because to me, like this, they're going to have the ability over the course of the season to figure out what works best. And they might start out with Gobert and Randle in the front court. And maybe Randle has a year where he's shooting the hell out of the ball, like he did a few years back, his first All-Star season with the Knicks. It's possible he has a hot shooting season. That could work. But ultimately, though, they're going to now have the ability to go with Gobert Randle or Randle Naz Reid with some more versatility. They can go with Gobert as the lone five, surrounded by even more shooters because of the DiVincenzo addition now. So that could be more effective than the Gobert only big lineup was last season. You could play small with Randle at the five, with McDaniels at the four and Anthony Edwards, and still have size and versatility. You can have just Naz Reid out there. And I just look at their front court combinations and I feel Minnesota raised their ceiling. They have more upside now, especially when you factor in Rob Dillingham. I know it's just one preseason game against a Lakers team that didn't have all their starters, but Dillingham scoring, I think, is going to translate pretty early on. I like Terrence Shannon. I like their pick last year, Leonard Miller. They have a lot of young guys that have talent that could have some upside for this team and that could carve out a rotation role, but you also have your solid eight. And with some youth that can break through and create more upside for that team. So my initial impression of the trade was, I don't know about the Randle Gobert front court, but with a lot more time to really marinate in it, I think Minnesota comes out better and they have a better chance to get through and actually make it to the finals next season.
Yeah, they were 17th in adjusted offensive rating in the regular season. They were better in the postseason thanks to Anthony Edwards and Naz Reid. And of course, you know, they need a little bit more depth and stretch with Dante DiVincenzo coming in as a great fit. And I too love Dillingham. And I've always loved Kentucky guys. Anyone playing for John Calipari exceeds expectations in the NBA, Julius Randle and Karl Anthony Towns. I know Karl Towns was a number one overall pick, but you look at the breadth of Kentucky guys.
He didn't shoot threes at Kentucky, Tom. He never shot threes.
He never shot threes at Kentucky, and he was also the SEC leader in block percentage. I know he started next to Willie Cauley-Stein, but like if you plotted out this career for Karl Anthony Towns based on what we saw at Kentucky, It's the total opposite. He's now the greatest big man three-point shooter, so he says, of all time, and he can't play defense. Coming out of college, Kentucky had the number one defense in college basketball. They won 38 straight games, and I would never have thought that Karl Anthony Towns would become this, you know, punching bag for his defense. But, man, I just love the comp for Chris Bosh because of the fact they're both quirky personalities. Chris Bosh was ridiculed in Toronto for not being like a winning player. And then all of a sudden he gets in the right coaching staff, the right environment. And man, when you have two elite defenders in Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby, just like LeBron and Dwayne Wade were defensively, it just unlocks so much and just kind of relieves a lot of the pressure for Cat. So I'm big on this trade for both teams. I'm a little bigger on the Knicks side, but I get it. Like if Julius Randle plays nice and if he looks at, okay, everyone in the league is going to want to see how I react to this very uncomfortable position of coming in as a new player in a contract year on a team that just went to the Western Conference Finals. This is a big pressure moment for Julius Randle, and I hope that pressure makes diamonds.
Well, like you said, with Kat in a new situation, Chris Finch, head coach of Julius Randle now, you had Tim Connelly, the GM of the Wolves, saying how Finchy has circled Julius Randle as a guy that he loves. Randle said he's loved playing for Finch more than any other coach in the league. So maybe it'll be the right spot for Randle too, and they'll get the most out of him. But ultimately, Minnesota needs these things to break right for them because they're going to have to need it to get through the Dallas Mavericks. The Mavericks, they played on Monday night. We did not get to see Klay Thompson, but we did see the fact that this is a brand new roster. They lost Tim Hardaway. They lost Josh Green. They lost Derek Jones. They replaced those guys with Klay Thompson, Najee Marshall, Quentin Grimes, and Spencer Dinwiddie. Now, I think the consensus overall has been that the Mavericks got better here this offseason. I don't think it's some guarantee. I know the biggest discrepancy between the Mavericks and the Celtics was the three-point shooting. Boston took 41 of their shots from three per game. The Mavericks barely took over 30. The Celtics had threats everywhere on the floor. The Mavericks had holes on every lineup. And Klay helps. Klay definitely helps. But I'm not convinced on Najee Marshall. I'm not convinced on Spencer Dinwiddie. Not convinced on Quentin Grimes. If you look at Najee Marshall, last year he shot almost 40% from three for the Pelicans, but he was below 30% in his previous 3 years of his career. He was below 30% in his 3 years in college. You look at Quentin Grimes, he had a great stretch with the Knicks at the end of the 22-23 season. He has done nothing since then. He's been provided chances. Those chances were taken by DiVincenzo. Meanwhile, Grimes pouted on the bench. Spencer Dinwiddie was very good last time he was in Dallas. He's done nothing since then with the Nets or the Lakers. And then even with Klay Thompson. Klay Thompson, love him, Hall of Famer. Still a great shooter, but no longer an elite shooter, at least statistically. If you pull up Klay's numbers pre-injury, he was 41.5% from three in the playoffs. That's dropped to 37.8% in the playoffs since the injury. His percentages in the regular season have also dropped too. So you Warriors fans became frustrated with his shot selection. He became more erratic, more mid-range jumpers, more me-first shots. The Warriors didn't want to overpay for good reason, and Dallas got him on a fair contract. But it's not like the Mavericks are getting prime Klay, 43%, 44% Klay Thompson from three, flamethrower Klay. So I get that all these additions and I get the excitement for the Dallas Mavericks, but I'm not sold they actually got better. Whereas with Minnesota and a lot of the other teams in the West, like the Thunder, I think they very clearly did get better.
So there's a lot of talk about Klay Thompson as the Ray Allen for this team. Ray Allen was 37. When he was with the Miami Heat. 37. Klay Thompson
still is over 40% from three his last couple years with Boston.
And he was coming off the bench. And so he was able to play 20 minutes and be really good in those 20 minutes. And he closed games for them for sure. But I don't think people realize like how good Ray Allen was. Like the idea of Ray Allen, I think they envision like late stage Boston Celtics, Miami Heat, Ray Allen. This dude could do so much more than just shoot. And so Klay Thompson, I think he's going to be able to get those corner threes from Luka Doncic, and the Dallas Mavericks created more corner threes than any team in the NBA last year during the regular season. But Klay Thompson is like mediocre-ish from the corners. It's not like he's 50% from the corners like you'd expect. If you look at the numbers, I think he's like 39%, which sounds good, but just about everybody shoots 39% or better from the corner. So you're paying a premium in terms of the acquisition and the hype around Klay Thompson when you probably could have gotten that kind of replacement value three-point shooting with Luka Doncic from a lot of different players that probably could have been a lot cheaper in terms of that contract. Klay Thompson defensively is a problem, and not in the social media problem. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like it's a problem in the 2005 sense where it's like, I don't know how this team upgraded defensively. I know they improved in the postseason, and Derek Lively and Daniel Gaffer were much better than we expected given their lack of postseason experience. But Derek Jones Jr. was really good for them last year in this role. And I got to say, I'm a huge Najee Marshall fan. I think actually that might be the best acquisition from like a Klay Thompson standpoint. The rest of their roster, I think Najee Marshall, I love him. I think you kind of have to see him in person to like really appreciate
Najee. Do you love him if he's shooting below 30% though, Tom? Is it only last year's Najee Marshall? Because I love last year's Najee Marshall. I'm a huge Marshall fan from last season. But prior to that, yeah, he's fine. He's okay.
He's okay, but I want more. I want to see more Najee Marshall if last year was legit. And sample size wasn't great. He was taking just a couple three-pointers at a pretty good percentage, not lights out. But I love his game. He's 7'1" wingspan. I think he's a better playmaker than people give him credit for, at least that he's shown. I know it's just like a scrimmage or what have you, but I think this guy, people love him. He's going to be a fan favorite in Dallas in ways that I think New Orleans fans loved watching this guy play. And when you see him, he's always jawing at the other team. He's just an energy guy. And I would love to see if that kind of spacing continues with Dallas, because as we know, Luka Doncic is always going to find you if you're open. And he has such a gravity out there that he's going to get more open three-point shots than what he saw in New Orleans last year. As good as Zion is at distributing and finding open shooters, I think there's nobody better than Luka Doncic at doing that. So I'm hopeful that Najee Marshall can capitalize on last season with more open threes. The thing about Klay Thompson, though, is playing next to Steph Curry, he's going to get open threes a lot, and still, he's not in that elite category that he needs to be to make himself worth that contract.
Sure. And I think with Najee Marshall, you see him set as a screener sometimes. Right now in preseason, we're seeing a ton of teams using inverted ball screens. Devin Booker setting screens. You got Gabe Vincent setting screens for LeBron James. It's happening everywhere where teams are trying to find their own Drew Holiday, their own Derek White, like Boston did. And Dallas last year would use Derek Jones as a screener for Luka. And Jones was a high flyer. Najee Marshall is not that, but he is more of a playmaker, like you said, where Luka could find him on a switch or off the short roll and he can make a play off the dribble. He's more than just a one-dimensional guy like Derek Jones as a lob threat. So I think Dallas is going to try to use him in creative ways. So even if the shot isn't working, he can add something. But the shot does need to work. It has to.
It has to work.
These guys need to.
And usually in Dallas, with playing next to Luka Doncic, you're going to hit your shots. And I do also want to make note, Najee Marshall said all he wants to do out there is throw lobs to Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford. And he was, I want that. I want more of it. I called it Lob City Dallas last year when they made the big trade at the deadline for PJ Washington and getting those guys in the fold and basically dunking on everybody. I love Najee Marshall's game. And I will say, if his three-point shot isn't falling, this could get really ugly in terms of the off-season acquisitions for Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Up next, I'm going to have some crazy questions for you, Tom, about this upcoming NBA season. But first, I want to remind our listeners, the mailbag. Email us at kocshow@yahoosports.com. Next Tuesday's episode will be the first mailbag episode. Please send video or audio notes if you can. We'll take written comments and emails as well. But video is preferred. That's kocshow@yahoosports.com. All right, Tom. I'm going to ask you some questions. All of these questions are going to start out with, is it crazy? Is it crazy? ... because this coming season, there's always something unexpected that happens. So I've got a lot on my mind. That cool?
Let's do it.
Okay. Let's start out with the defending champions, the Boston Celtics. They were consistently dominant last season. First third of the season, they were 21-6 with a 9.1 net rating. Second third of the season, 21-6 again with a 9.8 net rating. The remainder of the season, they were 22-6 with a 16.1 net rating before they went 16-3 in the playoffs with an 8.6 net rating. They won the finals. If it weren't for their game four blowout loss, they would have had one of the six best playoff net ratings ever. Top 20, still amazing. So Boston last season trended up every third of the season. Right now on BetMGM, they're plus 325 to win the finals again. Those are the shortest odds to repeat since the 17-18 Warriors were minus 180 to repeat. That was their third title. That more than cemented them as a dynasty, which brings me to our first is it crazy question. Is it crazy to believe, just like those Warriors, that the Celtics haven't even peaked yet and they're on the verge of becoming the NBA's next dynasty?
Dynasty. You dropped the dynasty word.
Yeah. Is it crazy?
It is crazy because every dynasty has a top 10 player on that squad. Every dynasty that we've looked at in NBA history, you need to have one of those guys. And they've done it unconventionally by having Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, not being like super heavy MVP candidates, but still being on like a 70 win pace, or at least their point differential suggests that they're a 70 win team, basically. Are they dynasty material? I think you're crazy. I think the team, if I'm going to put stock in a dynasty or a future dynasty, it's going to be OKC. It's going to be on that team that has basically 25 and under studs across the board. And yes, it's not like Boston, they have a bunch of Al Horfords out there. You got Jason Tatum, who's 26, Jaylen Brown, who's 28, Drew Holiday, yes, he's 34. But to me, I think it's premature to say dynasty. Another thing that I want to see is them go against Giannis. I want to see them go against Embiid. I want to see them go against the top of the top in the Eastern Conference before we start throwing around that D word. But given that the Eastern Conference has like a tier of by themselves, the Boston Celtics, I can understand why, you know, if the Celtics were playing in the West, it'd be a whole lot harder to get to that finals. But I think it's premature. I think you need to have a top 10 guy. I think you need to have a LeBron. I think you need to have a Steph, a Shaq, a Tim Duncan, a Larry, a Kareem. You need those guys to be on your team in order to have that sustainable next 10 years, every year going to be in the conversation. To me, I think it's premature.
Is it possible Tatum can get to that level? Is it possible? I mean, he's only going to be 26 this season. You got Tatum and Brown. They're two of the NBA's most durable stars. They've improved every year of their career. Tatum is, you know, seventh or eighth best player in the league. He has improved every single year of his career. Even when he was shooting like crap in the finals, he still was making a positive impact as a playmaker and as a defender. What if Tatum gets a bit better in the opening preseason games for Boston? Tatum's shot did look more fluid.
Yeah.
It looked better. So is it conceivable here that Tatum can become that top five guy in the prime years of his career when you got, look, I doubted Boston all of last season. I was so wrong about Boston. You hand as well, you're raising too. Your hand.
Yep. I picked Dallas in six, maybe. Them. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I said Dallas in six too. And I was so wrong about them. And then you got a summer in which Tatum makes Team USA, but he gets benched. Brown gets snubbed. Everybody's still doubting Boston. You got Joe Mazzulla, their crazy head coach, saying everybody says defending champions, we're the attacking champions. So you get the Celtics with an edge. Like, they look like they're out for revenge, even though they're the champions, attacking, defending, and whatever you want to call it, Joe Mazzulla. So I think about Boston from that standpoint, but also just the fact that they have paths to improve as well, besides Tatum and Brown. Derek White might be 30 years old, but he ran more pick and rolls per game last season than he did in his entire career. What if White continues getting better? What if Peyton Pritchard, their backup point guard, continues getting better? He's already a high-level backup point guard. What if Sam Hauser continues getting better? You got Jordan Walsh, who they drafted last year. I love Jordan Walsh as a prospect when he went to Arkansas. What if Walsh becomes a two-way guy, hitting spot-up threes? Versatile, hard-nosed, you know, Tony Allen-style defense for old Celtics fans. I just think Boston, Like, they entered last year saying, okay, we're going to give this 2 years with Tatum and Brown before it gets too expensive. And if it doesn't work, then we'll shuffle the deck and figure things out. But now you have an organization, Grosbeck's going to be selling the team, but they're doing everything they can to be trying to win a championship right now. So I went from feeling Boston's not going to win the finals to them winning it, and this full offseason happens, to feeling like who's really going to beat them in the East? Because I know they hadn't seen anybody in the postseason last year, but assuming great health for all teams, are you really picking Milwaukee or Miami or Philly over Boston? I'm not so sure that you are.
Yeah, but when you're throwing around the dynasty word, Kevin, it's
a
little
bit
different.
That's a big word. It's a big word.
Doesn't it make it
repeating? But if they repeat, suddenly that conversation does start.
Yeah, but in order for the Kevin Durant and Steph Curry team to repeat, they tried to do a three-peat. They got the repeat, but that was the only repeat of the last decade. And there have been three repeats in the last two decades, and they all had multiple all-time players on the team. Is Jason Tatum an all-time player? Yeah, but is he top 10 like LeBron James is? Is he top 30 all-time?
What if it's changed? What if having six top 40 guys is better than having one top five guy?
Sure.
Like, what if it just is?
I hear that. I hear that. And like after the finals, I wrote that piece about how the NBA might be just about the big five rather than the big two or the big three, that you need five guys who are playing at an all-star level because of injuries and because of, you know, just the different dynamics in the CBA. It might make more sense to have five all-star caliber, maybe not like three all like first team all NBA talents like the Miami Heat did back in 2012, or, you know, Draymond, Steph and KD. But the thing about it is you got a 7'3 guy coming off a pretty serious foot injury with Kristaps Porzingis, and he was a big part of what they were doing last year. And if you want to say, hey, they got Al Horford, dude's 38. So they're like an injury away from having Luke Kornet as their starting five. And he was good last year. And they were, I think they were like 7-0 or 6-1 when he was starting with the Celtics. But I'm a little nervous about Kristaps Porzingis long-term because of all of those injuries adding up to that left leg. But he was sensational last year. I think he wildly exceeded expectations in Boston, but I'm still nervous about a 7'3 dude with leg problems and potentially a pretty bad foot problem.
Absolutely. And that's the number one concern of Boston is the health of Porzingis. Like going in order of the standings last year, Boston, it's Porzingis. Knicks, you know, they're definitely a finals threat without a doubt. I believe you and I both agree on that, but they're a new group. Sometimes it takes teams time to gel, years to gel, like it did for Boston. Bucks are a threat with good health. Lillard apparently is in, you know, tip-top shape this season. Middleton, we'll see. He's on the older side as well. And Doc Rivers has blown enough 3-1 leads that I have concerns there. Cavs, I mean, you know, good, but I don't think they're a finals threat. Magic will be better. I think they could be a top 3 seed, but they're not quite there yet to me as a finals threat. Pacers are not there yet. Sixers, they definitely could be a finals threat. I think Maxey could improve. And B needs to prove he can stay healthy, but they are a threat as well. And the Heat don't have Boston's depth of top-end talent. Mm-hmm. I'd say there's four teams in the East that can win the finals. Boston, New York, Philly, and Milwaukee. Should I be putting Miami on that list, Tom?
Oof. I covered Eric Spoelstra for 6 years in Miami. I love what their front office does every year, retooling. I was not a fan of the Jimmy Butler acquisition. I thought he would have maybe one, maybe two good years left in him. And they've proven me wrong going to the finals, not just once. I do think that right now the window's this open. Mm. They can pry it open. But mm. I still want to see Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, Jaquez Jr. And I mean, if Jovic becomes the guy that they thought he was when they acquired him and made him, you know, this like teenage phenom that I think has a skill set at 6'10 to be somebody, but they need to supercharge. They need to speed that up because Jaquez Jr. and Jovic, they're going to have to age very quickly to be that third guy for them. And Jimmy Butler is getting way up there in age. He hasn't been able to be consistently healthy for them. I think is like the most he played in any stretch of the season without missing a game. It was like 12 games missing the playoffs last year. It's very clear they don't have the kind of depth that the other teams at the top do. They don't have those three stars yet. If they can get three or maybe four, sure, we can talk about them as a real title contender. But even still, KOC, when they had those guys, those two guys, Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler on the floor last year, 50 games together, they were 27 and 23. You know, that's not elite. You want to see more, but I never count out Pat Riley, Eric Spoelstra, and Andy Ellisberg. That front office, they find a way to keep that title contention door open, but it might take a big-time deal, whether it's moving one of those young guys or just saying, you know what, we're going to build around Bam Adebayo and Tyler Hero and Jimmy Butler. We've had fun. We've had great highs, but there's some lows here, and maybe it's time to, you know, pry open that contender window by basically saying we're going to build around Bam Adebayo rather than Jimmy Butler.
Well, it's probably a good start that Jimmy Butler didn't show up like this lead singer of My Chemical Romance. He showed up serious. He's supposedly going to be trying, you know, throughout the entire regular season. We might see playoff Jimmy all regular season, and that could change things for them. So could Bam Adebayo shooting threes. He closed last year shooting over 40% on about a three a game over the last month. Small sample size, but he says he's going to continue doing it. I know on Monday night the Heat held a scrimmage. He was shooting threes and that, doing pick and pops with Jimmy Butler. I saw a post about that. So there are lanes for the Heat to get into that conversation. But to me, I think you need to see it first from Miami. Which is why my next is a crazy question. We don't know we're going to see that. Is it crazy to suggest that Miami is more likely to see Butler end up demanding a trade? Is that possible? Contract year. Miami's just sputtering around and Butler's like, you know what? I got to take advantage of this season I'm having. Is that more probable?
I think it is more probable. Wow. And you know what? That doesn't mean that the Jimmy Butler experiment was not a success. It was.
Two finals appearances is nothing to you know, pout about. That's serious.
It's incredible. How many conference finals have Joel Embiid has had in his entire career? And the Miami Heat are there like every year, right? So I think, Jimmy Butler is one of those larger-than-life personalities that can be great in the same way that Tom Thibodeau, like for a long time, it was like 2 years, and then that third year of Tom Thibodeau, it just gets really tiring and people start to tune him out. Jimmy Butler, I think, has had, what, 5 seasons in Miami at this point? Is it 6? That's way more in terms of high-level play than I had expected out of Jimmy Butler leaving the Thibodeau miles in Chicago and in Minnesota. And then I just feel like, you know what? It might be time. I don't know where he goes, because I think the Miami Heat are over the first apron at this point. And when you look at the contract, it's going to be tough to be able to find a suitor for that personality, because he's not just a guy. He's not Chris Middleton out here where you can plug and play and just expect high-level performance. He is a dude that is going to walk into every locker room and you're going to feel him every single time. And so I think when you talk about Jimmy Butler and what the Miami Heat could get for him, I do think that you might have this this game of chicken between Jimmy Butler and Pat Riley, two of the most proud personalities, large personalities, stubborn isn't the right word, but I do feel like Pat Riley and Jimmy Butler, if they're not right, it's gonna be ugly fast.
Yeah, and I think with Jimmy Butler, even if he were to demand a trade, no guarantee necessarily that Pat Riley is going to end up finding a deal that he wants to do or that would agree to doing. Let's move on to the Western Conference, Tom. We have 4 teams in the East that we feel like are solid final threats, maybe 5, depending on what happens with Miami. In the West, I'd say there's 4 locks: the Mavericks, the Nuggets, the Timberwolves, and Thunder. They belong in the conversation. And then the Suns and the Grizzlies should be there as well. The Pelicans are on the rise. They look, Zion Williamson looks like he's in tip-top shape. Good for him, and hopefully he can stay healthy. The Rockets are on the ascent, but they're not quite there yet. The Clippers, they feel like they're stuck in limbo. Paul George is gone. Kawhi Leonard has uncertain health. What about the Lakers and Warriors, though? Do you have any lingering belief in either of them as contenders?
I'm always a believer in Steph Curry. I am always a believer in that dude.
Me too.
I just can't count him out, especially what we saw in the gold medal game with a guy that I think people were wondering, is this it? Like, if he can't assert himself on this Team USA team, how much longer do you think he has this prime? And I'm telling you, prime. Like, Steph Curry still, when he's out there, he's one of the 5, 7 best players in the NBA. And as long as he's doing that, I still think that they have another, you know, I wouldn't say championship run in them, but I do think with their acquisitions this offseason, I love what they did. I love DeAnthony Melton. I know he's injured all the time, but he's a super high IQ player that fits in that system. Kyle Anderson, also love that acquisition. You're talking about amplifiers. Like you mentioned that with Karl-Anthony Towns. First time I heard that term was with Steve Kerr talking to him about Andre Iguodala's Hall of Fame chances. Like he was like, oh, 100% Andre Iguodala is a Hall of Famer. And sometimes you'd be like, okay, the coach is obviously going to stump for his guy, right? But he said, name me another guy that consistently amplified the best players around him. It's Andre Iguodala. It's Scottie Pippen. It's guys who take the best at what you do and just make it that much better. And he doesn't take anything away. So Andre Iguodala is a great comp for someone like Kyle Anderson, who's just, he's a guy who can do a little bit of everything. He's a good playmaker, really good defender. He's not a great shooter in the same way that Andre Iguodala, not his strength. But I do think that those guys are amplifiers. And Pajemski, I love his game. I'm talking myself into a 50-win season from the Golden State Warriors.
Wow. So would you put them ahead of any of the six teams that I already mentioned? Mavericks, Nuggets, Timberwolves, Thunder, Suns, Grizzlies. Right now, the Thunder being the betting favorite. Are you, like, if you're power ranking in the West, are the Warriors ahead of any of them, or do you need to see it? You're just holding out hope.
I need to see. But the one that I'm most nervous about that I think could fall is the Denver Nuggets.
Because they added Russell Westbrook.
They added Russell Westbrook. They lost KCP and Jamal Murray. That contract is terrifying to me. Yeah. Jamal Murray, what we saw from him in the offseason, what we saw from him, I get it. Like, he's been nursing some injuries, but from what you hear around the league is that he wasn't as dedicated or as motivated to be in shape in last season, and they wanted him to get in better shape. And this is a situation where, like, you saw, the proof was in the pudding. Like, he did not look good for Canada, and they just handed him a monster extension.
Not
here.
Not at all.
So, like, with Denver, I know you're going to get MVP caliber performance from Jokic. I just worry about Russell Westbrook, his impact on that team, and the Jamal Murray situation terrifies me. A lot of bad vibes for me with Denver Nuggets, and I'm telling you, man, there's this weird championship curse where 3 years out of a championship in the last like six champions, they've all missed the playoffs. You look at Milwaukee, you look at Los Angeles, you look at the Golden State Warriors. Denver Nuggets right now are in their year three after winning a championship. And all of those teams, they missed the playoffs 3 years after winning the title. So all these things are coming together. And I'm not ready to say that they're going to fall out of the playoffs. I just think they're going to have a lot higher chance of things falling apart than the other teams on that list.
Well, the West is stacked, too. You could win 49 games and be in the play-in.
Yep.
You know, like Dallas was almost in the play-in and they had 50 last year. Their whole year could have been different with one or two less wins. So for Denver, yes, you're picking them to be a, you know, top four seed. They have a guy who could go for three MVPs in a row here and Jokic, but they definitely have some concerns on their team as well. You, like you said, you lose KCP 1 year after you lose Bruce Brown. I love Christian Brown with what he could potentially provide, yep. But can he do it in a bigger role with more minutes? How do the rookies from last year, Julian Strother, Hunter Tyson, Jalen Pickett, do any of them carve out minutes after 1 year in which Michael Malone, their head coach, was unwilling to even give those guys extended opportunity? Or is he just going to rely on the veterans? Is he not going to develop those young guys? There's a lot of questions with Denver right now, on top of the big ones, like you said, with Jamal Murray, on top of Russell Westbrook. Can he be an additive piece and not a negative like he was with the Lakers and the Clippers? So I think with Denver, that's fair. And then there's the upside guys. There's like Pelicans with Zion. What if Zion has a top five MVP level season? What if Houston takes a leap with some of their young guys and they become a team that they're a six seed or a seven seed? Somebody's going to fall. And you talked about the Warriors with their upside. I feel the same way with the Lakers. I think with the Lakers, two things need to happen for them to be a top six seed in the West. Anthony Davis needs to be in the borderline top five MVP conversation, first time all NBA. And that maybe that happens. Maybe that happens. You have JJ Redick, who was hinting a couple of weeks back that he has an idea of how to fix AD's jumper. He shot a handful of jumpers, including three-pointers, in his preseason debut for the Lakers this year. Shot looked smooth. He looked tremendous. The Lakers' offense is utilizing far more movement than Darvin Ham's offenses ever did. You have Dalton Knecht, Jalen Hood-Schifino, Max Christie, all under 24 years old. If any of their youth can explode, suddenly the Lakers either have guys that they're going to want to keep or young players that they could potentially flip to further enhance the roster. And LeBron James turns 40 in December, but I don't think it's crazy to say that he could still be a top 10 player by season's end. So like if you have two top 10-ish guys with LeBron and AD, with an improved system, with an improved supporting cast, the Lakers could be right there in it too. And we mentioned all of those teams, and I mentioned Grizzlies as a team that belongs in that, but they have Ja back. And they're not in the playoffs last year. Somebody good is going to fall out of the West. The conference imbalance is so significant right now when you look at the East versus the West.
You know, we've already talked about Bronny James before and how the second generation effect in the NBA is maybe the best in terms of halo effect of prospects coming into the league, whether your father played in the NBA, is huge. There's institutional knowledge. There's, just the genetic side of things is that if your father played in the NBA, you're probably athletic and you're probably really strong and you're gifted athletically and you're going to have a long career. But that said, I just worry that the Bronny James thing kind of sucks the life out of that locker room and becomes a sideshow for the Lakers season. It's just, it becomes this thing that everyone in the locker room is afraid to mention, hey, this is kind of distracting.
You're telling me that the guy's getting 25 minutes per game shooting 17% from three?
I think that is not a good situation, Kevin.
I don't think he's going to play that much. I really don't. I think he'll play a little bit and then play with the South Bay Lakers, their G League team.
I hope that's the case, man. I hope that's the case.
Needs to happen.
But that's what scares me about the Lakers. When you mentioned it, I was like, you know what? Yeah, I'm talking myself into 50 wins out of this team. But then I remember about the Bronny James effect, or the impact of that and that whole, what it could be a circus. And I've been in the LeBron James circus before. It's not fun. To have him have to answer questions about all of these insane things that have nothing to do with basketball for an entire season, that really, that is very grating on someone like LeBron who just wants to hoop. This is a situation that, on paper, and we could say this about a lot of teams in the NBA, Kevin, on paper, this feels like a 50-win team, but I just worry about that Bronny James situation, that they're going to try to force things a little bit, and I'm still bullish on him long-term, 3-4 years down the line, maybe not now, but new head coach in JJ Redick, who's showing some really good things in the preseason so far and saying the right things, but I'll believe it when I see it when it comes to the Los Angeles Lakers this season.
Well, you're bullish on Bronny. I'm very bearish on Bronny. I just don't see it at all. He's never shot the ball well. He's undersized. I think Bronny is a nice defender, nice ball mover, but he's, in all likelihood, unless he becomes a knockdown shooter, but he's a below 70% guy from the free throw line going back to high school and college. The indicators are not great for Bronny as a shooter. So I'm not quite there with him. But I do think the Lakers could be a lot better than people anticipate. I love the way their offensive system looks in preseason. Anytime you have AD, you should have a top defense. So health with LeBron be at 40 come this December, and AD with his injury history is the big concern there. Memphis. I want to talk about Memphis real quick, Tom, because you got Ja Morant coming back, plays on Monday night. With Ja returning to that team, you also have Marcus Smart coming back. He played only 20 games last year. You have a young guy like GG Jackson ascending for that team. He's going to miss 3 months, though, because of a foot injury, but he averaged 20 points per game over the last month last year. You got some veterans, Jaren Jackson Jr., Defensive Player of the Year, Desmond Bane, elite shooter. You got some youth coming up. And the guy that I feel, of all the names in that roster, is really the biggest X factor, is Zach Edey.
Yes.
Zach Edey. They draft him in the top 10, Tom. 7'4", 300 pounds, immediate lob threat who sets pulverizing screens. He's a post threat. He can overpower anybody. And guess what? He's going to be shooting threes for that team. I had Edie 7th on my board. Chris Vernon, my old co-host, may think Edie's going to be a bust, but I may regret not ranking him higher. I love Zach Edie, and I don't think it's going to be long until he clearly is the guy that people look at the Memphis Grizzlies and they say, wait a second, is it crazy to say that the Grizzlies are actually the favorite in the West?
Oh, I think that's crazy. I think that's crazy. And here's why.
So you don't think there's any chance that they get there? No chance.
I think there's very little chance. I think it's crazy to suggest that all of these guys will miraculously be super healthy this season after what we saw last year. And the biggest predictor of injury is prior injury. That is a truism since the day the NBA started in the 40s or 50s. This is the NBA where if you have an injury that sets you back an entire season, it's not like we can press the reset button in 2K and be like, oh yeah, you're good this year. There are injuries that have—
Breaking news, Tom. Breaking news on that exact note. Just minutes ago, Ja Morant headed back to the locker room after turning his ankle. He asked to come out of the game. So on that exact note, just minutes ago, Ja Morant turned his ankle and asked to come out of the game.
You got to be kidding
Second me. Quarter. Yeah.
Okay, so GG Jackson.
Wow.
Maybe the coolest story of the season last year. Out 3 months.
Yep.
Vince Williams, stress fracture in his leg. He's out for weeks figuring that out. Jaren Jackson Jr., gimpy hamstring at practice, or he's out for a couple weeks, maybe okay for the season opener. Now you're telling me Ja Morant came up with a bum ankle and he had to leave the game? So this team, they lost 578, I'm going to say that again, 578 games lost due to injury.
That's a big number, Tom.
It is a huge, it is not a small digit, okay? It is so big, Kevin, that is the largest for any team in NBA history, the most injury-riddled season in NBA history. They had 51 different starting lineups, 33 different players suit up, and that's the most in NBA history. The two teams that even come close to that, the 03 Raptors, the Toronto Raptors, had 519 games lost due to injury. They won 33 games the following season. The Boston Celtics in 97, I think it was Antoine Walker's rookie year, right around there. They were 36-46 the next season. A big jump. But they didn't have the talent of this team. I'm just a little worried here that we're talking leading the West. I know maybe this Ja Morant injury changes things, but prior injury is the best predictor for future injury. And looking up and down this roster, I just can't say that I have any confidence that they're going to have three, much less four or five of those guys that were out last year being healthy. I love Zach Edey, but if that's the difference between you and having who would be their starting five behind Zach Edey if he goes down for whatever reason, it's as thin as Ja Morant, that depth at the five position.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm with you with Memphis. I think it's crazy.
Okay.
Just asking the question.
Okay. I don't know whether you're saying like, this is my take. Is it, are you as crazy as I am about this take?
I think some thoughts that are out there in the basketball world. When you talk to other media members, other executives, fans who are friends, like I just thoughts that are out there about some of these teams. And with Memphis, you know, you look at their additions, look at their health. You have some people, you know, including Verno, you know, my old friend, I'll love him forever. Verno, who thinks like this team has that upside, like going from worst to first. And I just think there's too many questions with Memphis. And even aside from health, like Ja Morant is a 32% guy from three in his career. He's not an elite shooter by any means. And the NBA, from the last time we saw him in the playoffs, when he was dominant, to be fair, the NBA is even more extreme right now when it comes to daring those iffy shooters to shoot. The league this year is going to be allowing more physicality. How does that impact him on attacking the basket as well? I want to see Ja get back to that elite level. Like I would need to see them in February, March, looking like they're on a 65-win pace, a 60-win pace to feel like this team has a real shot at the finals.
Okay, so since you're a draft expert, and I get this is one of my pet peeves with the way we talk about prospects. But if I said to you, Zach Edey is going to be like a bulkier Rick Smith's career.
Hmm.
You would say, I'm in? Or you would be like, come on, man, that's, he's better than Rick Smith's. Like, he can have a better career than that. If I gave you that comp for his career as Rick Smith's, what would you say?
I think he can have a better career than that. I do. I think, you know, Rick Smith's plays in the NBA at a time where bigs are the dominant force. And you have Zach Edey coming into the NBA where bigs are the dominant force again. But there's nobody that does exactly what Edey does. The NBA back then was very post-centric. Mm-hmm. The bigs today are very perimeter-oriented. And Edey is more of that player who I think can be a complete punisher inside. Edey could be somebody, and the reason why I had him ranked so high and why I believe Memphis drafted him so high is because he, like, you have all these teams that are zigging. Memphis is zagging with Edey, where yes, he can do the typical big man stuff nowadays. He has a lob, you know, he can grab offensive boards, kick it out, put it back, but he can also be somebody that's posting up and dominating down there like he did and continued improving every year of his career at Purdue. So I think Edey can be one of those guys that becomes like a bona fide all-star player. Defense is going to have to be the thing that improves for him, but he has improved at Purdue every single year. He became very good at Purdue. The Purdue system told Edey, do not foul, do not contest shots. We cannot afford you to have foul trouble. But in the moments that he did try to defend, I always think about the block he had against Dalton Connect. I think when they faced Tennessee, Sweet 16, Elite 8, whatever it was. The block on Connect at the end of the game when he extended out just looked like a dominant rim protector. Edey is so freaking big. Huge. And now you have Marcus Smart on the perimeter and Jaren Jackson flanking him at the four. All Edey needs to do is sit back and play Brook Lopez and become a dominant shot blocker and rebounder. So I'm extremely, extremely bullish on what Edey can be in the NBA. And I think he landed in the absolute perfect situation for his career, provided his point guard stays healthy, John Morant.
John Morant, I was already a little nervous about him coming back from the shoulder surgery and whether that would have some sort of like little tick in his brain about like driving to the basket and being as ferocious around the rim. Now you're throwing an ankle injury into that and the physicality that the referees are going to swallow the whistle, what it seems like, according to Rick Carlisle. All of this stuff, not great vibes in Memphis right now.
Yeah. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show wherever you're listening to this podcast. All right, Tom, let's talk about a few more teams. One team in the West that we didn't really talk too much about is Phoenix. Is it crazy to believe the Suns are the contender most likely to blow it up?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. You look at that
payroll. Not crazy.
It's north of $400 million all said and done with the luxury tax and the second apron and the multiplier of all the, it's not just that you're over the luxury tax. It's the more you're into the luxury tax, the more that you have to pay on every dollar that you're in it. This is going to be the most expensive roster in NBA history. Okay. You're dealing with a KD that just went to Paris Olympics and just latched on to Anthony Edwards. And Anthony Edwards is already talking about Kevin Durant in his preseason press conferences about how much he wants to play, or at least he's saying, hey, keep that guy in the same breath as Steph and LeBron. The Minnesota Timberwolves just cleared a lot of long-term cap space, or at least got a lot of long-term money off the books. And then you have the New York Knicks. And I'm writing a column about this. The New York Knicks are led by Leon Rose, who used to run the CAA basketball division, the top agency in sport, in the NBA. They have over $1 billion under contract right now in the NBA, the most in the league for any agency. And the biggest contract on the books is, oh wait, it's tied between Karl-Anthony Towns and Devin Booker, two guys who played with each other at Kentucky, okay? They've been tied at the hip. Like in every year they talk about this, oh, the Goodfellas, oh, me, Devin Booker, Karl-Anthony Towns, and D'Angelo Russell, we're going to play together one day. And like the stars were aligning as I was looking at this Karl-Anthony Towns trade with Minnesota. And I'm looking at the Phoenix Suns and being like, they better get off to a good start. They don't have any cap flexibility. They didn't have a good year last year. the Bradley Beal no trade clause, which is already just like, yuck, I do not want that on my roster. They don't have anywhere to go. If this doesn't go right, what are they going to do, Kevin? Unless they blow it up, we're like, Matt Ishbia, he's kind of cornered. The only thing they could have done this offseason really is upgrade at the coaching position. And they fired Vogel and brought in Mike Budenholzer. And I love Mike Budenholzer and I love the staff that he built. But I just kind of feel like the Phoenix Suns are this ticking time bomb. It just feels like if they don't get off to a good start, we could be seeing a fire sale by the end of end of January.
Well, on the note of the Suns blowing it up, I don't think we can forget Woj back in June reporting that Houston wanted to trade for Kevin Durant, that Houston has the picks to make the Suns whole again was the phrasing that Woj used. So whether it's Minnesota or whether it's Houston or whoever it might be in OKC homecoming, we know back in June that Woj had talked about the idea of Kevin Durant trades, and sometimes things that are talked about or, at a high level between owners or even just thought about within front offices become a reality during the season. After all, that's what happened when KD was first traded in the first place. He demanded a trade from the Nets and it didn't happen until during the season. So the Phoenix Suns, you get a new head coach in Mike Budenholzer. He's trying to do new things with that offense. They add a real point guard in Tyus Jones. They promised him he'd start when other teams only wanted to keep him as a sixth man. You get Yusuf Nurkic trying to add the three-pointer. I'm very doubtful on Nurkic as a reliable shooter or much of anything at this stage of his career. So I think with Phoenix, you got questions at the center spot. You got questions with your depth still, even though you add Royce O'Neal and you got Grayson Allen coming back more buff and you have some guys, Ryan Dunn, you drafted. You got Iguodaro playmaking big off the bench. There's a lot of ifs, a lot of unproven guys, and Phoenix very well could be like a sixth seed. And if you're a sixth seed and you don't feel like you actually can win at all, maybe Ishbia is like, you know what? Let's get all of our picks back and be pretty good. But let's try to spin it, kick the can forward and become a finals contender in a few years. It's just tough though, man. Cause at that point, OKC's better. The Spurs have a better team around Wemby. So if you don't go for it now, when are you actually going to go for it? If you're Phoenix?
I know, but they've got this roster for the next 2 years at that kind of payroll. Oh. And it's just Bradley Beal's got two more years. He's got a player option in 3 years, but he's got two more years of $50+ million on the books. And I'm not sure he's a top 100 player in the NBA anymore, and he's getting paid $50 million, and he's got a no trade clause. So if you're going to get any value, because the thing about with Kevin Durant is at that stage of his career, there's the injury question of just like, if you don't trade him now, things could just get, really bad really quickly. If you don't, make a decision when, okay, where are we going with this roster? Can we pivot now, get some picks back, replenish our roster? Because what you're looking at is not just, hey, we're going to be shelling out a lot of money. The way the CBA is built, you don't have any options. There's no optionality with this roster right now unless you decide to move off of Kevin Durant because you're not – I mean, where's Bradley Beal's contract in terms of movability right now at this point?
Zero?
It's over. It's over. You're not going to be able to move that contract anymore. And so you're really looking at Devin Booker or Kevin Durant at this point. I like what they did this offseason in terms of, okay, you got Mike Budenholzer and you brought in a guy who knows how to, win a championship and at least get something out of Bradley Beal and that trio where it was like, man, I hope that when they're healthy, they can really do something. They got swept. They're not even close to winning a championship. And I can't remember the last time a team got swept and then became a legit finals team after that. There's a lot of work to be done in Phoenix. And I do think that the New York Knicks would love if Devin Booker became available. I'm not saying he is going to be available, but I know that the New York Knicks, the way that they set up their books going forward and the reason why they had that Jalen Brunson contract, it wasn't just about Karl Anthony Towns. I think they have aspirations to go big game hunting for the next couple years. And I know Devin Booker would be at the top of any GM's list, but especially his former agent in Leon Rose, who's running the Knicks right now.
Let's talk about a team that's definitely going to suck this season, the Brooklyn Nets. they had a free throw golf competition after one of their practices over the weekend where like a swish on a free throw is -2. If a ball rimmed in, it would be -1. If you miss, it's a +1. So like with golf, the lower the score, the better. The winner of that competition was Dorian Finney-Smith. He was a -27. Dennis Schroeder was a -21. Daron Sharp, their backup center, 60% free throw guy in his career, -7. Ben Simmons was a +11. Last, worst, on the Brooklyn Nets, right ahead of Nick Claxton, a +9, and I don't even like to say his name anymore, Killian Hayes, a +2. Rough start for Ben Simmons. Is it crazy, Tom, to say despite this horrible start for Ben Simmons, that he'll be right and that he's back healthy and that Ben Simmons will be a positive story this season for the Brooklyn Nets?
What is the most annual, the most annoying annual tradition in the NBA? Is it Ben Simmons? Ben Simmons shooting, or is it Bam Adebayo 3-point shot? What is it at this point where it's just like, I can bet that on October 3rd, we are going to be hearing about this new thing in the preseason. Finally, it's going to come together. I'm done with the Ben Simmons thing. I'm done. Like, I just, this isn't a case of he needs to shoot more free throws. When you talk to experts about the yips or about a player who completely has lost confidence in his free throw form or taking a jumper, it's not about going into the gym and shooting 3,000 free throws like you see in the comment section of every story about Ben Simmons. This is about something mental, something about that there's just something that is has that glitch. This dude used to have an ability to shoot the ball. It just doesn't work when he's out on the floor. And I'm sorry, but I'll believe it when I see it. When he's out in a game and he's shooting threes or he's shooting reliable jumpers or making free throws, I'll believe it when I see it. When the lights aren't even on. Wait a minute. How did this get out? Did the Nets tweet this out? Like, how did this get out? The scoreboard thing.
One of their reporters took a picture and posted it. I think it was kind of like something they talked about and joked about after practice. But the whole scoreboard was posted on social media. +11 for Ben Simmons. That seems really tough to do for an NBA player.
What was it? really Orlando Magic whiteboard that got out? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like this, yes. This seems like they may not have wanted this out there. Like maybe cover up that whole scoreboard thing. Cause now we're talking about Ben Simmons, but is this an opportunity for you to talk about which hand he's using? Like
we already know this. It's established, Tom. Ben Simmons shoots with the wrong hand and his 4 years away from playing the game of basketball with an assortment of reasons, he didn't switch hands. You know, when he was with Philadelphia many years ago, one of their old shooting coaches, this guy, John Townsend.
Oh, yeah.
There's video of John Townsend and Ben Simmons working together with Ben Simmons shooting right-handed free throws. Ben Simmons has had people in his life and his circle, coaches, executives, teammates, that have suggested to him to switch shooting hands. And he's never done it because he's too stubborn, because it's in his head, and he wants to stick with the left hand. And unfortunately, things have created for him. I'm rooting for him. I would love to see Ben Simmons get back to an all defensive team level. I'd love to see him in a situation with shooters zipping around him and he's making nice, you know, highlight reel passes. But the guy that was a, you know, an all-star level talent before is not there anymore. And yes, it is crazy to say it becomes a positive story. Maybe next year on a league minimum or a low contract, he goes to a contending team and they're like, we'll have him come off the bench and be our, you know, Draymond Jr. Or, you know, whatever they want, however they envision it. But this year, this is more of a prove it year for Ben Simmons, staying healthy, showing you can defend, and then maybe next year, take it into next year and do something then. But I don't see it this year for Ben Simmons.
No. And you know, Andre Drummond, I think, had a similar, not to the same extent, but like he went from an all-star guy to a vet minimum guy who proved that like at this level, I can be a contributor in the NBA. And I think that might be the case with Ben Simmons. I think I low-key, not that I stole your idea, but I remember doing research on Russell Westbrook and whether he shoots with the wrong hand. Have you ever heard that theory that Russell Westbrook actually is shooting with the wrong hand? Because he writes...
Shock me. He's the worst low-volume three-point shooter in league history.
but like he actually shoots right-handed, but he does everything left-handed.
Yeah.
And so if he just shot left-handed, I don't think it's to the same level of Ben Simmons, that it's a total disaster. But I do think that Russell Westbrook might have a Ben Simmons situation on his hands.
It would not shock me one bit. I know J.J. Redick many, many, many years ago, I think he was maybe still with Yahoo at this time on his podcast. He had mentioned how he thought DeAndre Jordan shot with the wrong hand. And I looked up the numbers with DeAndre Jordan, and it's amazing, actually. DeAndre Jordan, like in his career, when DeAndre Jordan dunked the ball, he dunked the ball with his right hand like 80% of the time to 20% for his left hand. So that's like lob dunks, open dunks, transition dunks. If it's right or left, not both, like two-handed dunks. If it was right or left, I think it was like 80% in favor of his right hand, and he was a left-handed shooter. So like there's these players out there with Ben Simmons, it's the same thing. Lefty shooter from the free throw line and from the perimeter as a shooter, but at the rim, layups, floaters, hook shots, post-ups. Ben Simmons, it was like 75% of his shots came off the right hand. And that's just not the case for like right-handed shooter. They go with the right hand at the rim. So like there's certain guys that have it wrong. And then you have certain guys that I think are truly ambidextrous that can use both at a high level. And one of those guys, this will be our last topic of the night, that's Reed Sheppard. Reed Sheppard, he can do everything on the floor. Defensively, he can poke at the ball, block shots with either hand. Offensively, he can finish with either hand. He just has amazing natural touch. Right now on BetMGM, they have Reed Sheppard at plus 600 to win Rookie of the Year. That's second behind Zach Edey at plus 450. We both had Reed Sheppard number one on our boards. We talked about him on my draft podcast earlier this year and raved about him. That conversation is one of the reasons why I felt like, screw it, I'm putting Reed number one. I'm going with what my heart's telling me. But in Houston, you got Fred VanVleet, Jalen Green, Amen Thompson in the backcourt. You're going to have Alperen Şengün getting touches. There's a lot of mouths to feed. Is it crazy to bet on Reed Sheppard as Rookie of the Year? It feels like there's too many weapons there in Houston for him to be the Rookie of the Year, doesn't it?
You know, Zach Edey's getting a lot of love for Rookie of the Year because he's going to get a lot of opportunities. And the question for me is not about talent. It's not about whether he can play at the NBA level right now, which I think he can. It's about opportunities. And they've got too many bodies right now in front of Reed Sheppard for me to feel good about that plus 600 right now. I do think he's the best player in this class, this rookie class. I do think he has the best long-term future in this class. And we talk about, oh, a guy at that size, how can... Dude, the dude is way more athletic. I know this is kind of a trope at this point, but if you watch this guy play, he is not a stiff out there. He's not Steph Curry playing below the rim. He's a lot more dynamic, a lot more athletic, and I think he's just a much better shooter than what you saw at Kentucky. Even though he was great percentage-wise, I just think volume-wise, he's way more than what I think he shot at Kentucky, and same thing for that guy, Devin Booker, who turned out to be a much better NBA player than he showed at college. I love Reed Sheppard, but it's going to take, I don't know, Fred VanVleet, a trade. He's got a team option for next year, so he becomes basically an expiring contract for any acquisition, any big star. He's basically, you know, get off any money. He could be an attractive piece at the deadline if they decide we got to accelerate this Reed Sheppard timeline. I do think by the end of the year, I think people will start coming onto our little bandwagon here with Reed Sheppard. I don't know. Is there any more room on this bandwagon for Reed Sheppard? I know he went number three, but I feel like we're leading this charge that Reed Sheppard is the real deal. He is not Steph Curry, but I think he is the closest thing to Steph Curry that we've seen in a long time.
I'm right there with you, Tom. The dude is an incredible shooter, 45%+ in every single metric at the college level, off screens, off the dribble, spot up. Didn't matter which direction he was coming off of the movement. Reed Sheppard is truly a magnificent shooter, and he can do more than that because he's so feisty on defense. He can block. He had, I believe, three block shots in the final 2 minutes of close games last season for Kentucky. He's a clutch defensive player. He's a playmaker on defense in the passing lanes. He's a smart, intelligent player on offense within the flow of the offense as a passer. I just think Reed Sheppard's going to be a good ball player for a decade plus in his career. And I mean, sometimes with those guys, you say he's not Stephen Curry. He'll never be Steph. There's never going to be a Steph. But Reed Sheppard could, if he reaches peak level, could become a top 10, top 15, top 20 guy in the NBA. I don't think you can necessarily rule that out with the importance of shooting ability in the NBA today. But opportunity isn't there quite yet as a rookie, and Houston has a lot of other mouths to feed right now. So I don't love Reed Sheppard as the rookie of the year pick, but we'll see. Who knows? He could exceed expectations just like he did his freshman year at Kentucky. Tom, I hear you have a podcast coming. Is that true? Maybe I have a podcast coming? Rumors?
Yeah. We'll have a little Easter egg. We've already kind of mentioned this phrase on this podcast, but you know what? You have to go listen back maybe 10 times, re-download this, unsubscribe, resubscribe, download 1,000 times over just to figure out what I may be having in plans for this season at Yahoo. I'm very excited about it.
Well, I'm excited for that, Tom. I'm excited to have you on every single week on this show. This is fun, man. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, this was awesome, man. Can't wait.
All right. I've received a ton of messages and emails asking about my transition to Yahoo Sports. So just want to address that right now. If you're tuning into the debut episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show, the odds are you know me from my 8 years working for the legend, the podfather, Bill Simmons. I just got to say thank you to Bill, Chris, Juliet, Sean, and Mallory for all the memories there. Their love and support they gave me and my family when my dad was dying from cancer. The chance they gave a young basketball blogger years ago, like everything behind the scenes, working with me, like Bill was the best boss I ever could have asked for. And I'm always going to be grateful to the five of them for giving me that chance. I remember it was around this time, 8 years ago, that Juliet Littman sent me an email asking if I'd like to go on a podcast with Chris Vernon. He was the host of the Ringer NBA show. I did. It went pretty well. 1 week turned into another week and another week. And then Verno became my co-host for 8 years. And now he's a friend for life. And I'm always going to love that dude. He's somebody I'm always going to cherish. And, you know, a lot of our longtime listeners are disappointed why I wasn't able to say goodbye on that show. It's perfectly okay. It's understanding that not all things can work out. But Verno has an open invitation to come on here and anytime he wants to talk Grizzlies, to talk NBA. He's just going to admit that I was right about Zach Edey and he was wrong about it. But I love Verno. I'm always going to love that dude. And I'm always going to love you guys, the listeners over the years. You've warmed my heart every single time one of you messaged me online or said hello in person. The two live shows Verno and I did in LA and Memphis are two memories that I'm always going to have forever. And I wish we'd been able to have done more of them. Those were a lot of fun. But none of this would have been possible without all of your love and support. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I hope you'll continue on this journey with me here because now we move forward together with Yahoo Sports. I'm pumped about what we're building here. I love our leadership led by Ryan Spoon and Sam Farber. I'm super thankful to them for giving me this chance. Already, this team has been incredibly energizing to work with. It's filled with hardworking, open-minded people. And over the course of time, I'm super excited to see what we can build together. So if you're still listening at this point of the podcast, odds are you're the type of person who'd like to get involved with the show. You may have been someone who hit up our past mailbags. If you want to hit up this one, just email me at kocshow@yahoosports.com. Like I said earlier, video notes and voice memos go to the front of the line, though we're going to accept written questions as well. Thank you again for listening to the premiere episode of the KOC Show. Please be sure to subscribe if you haven't done that already and give us a 5-star rating if you're listening on Apple. A big thanks to Tom Haverstraw for joining and to John and the entire production team that's hustling behind the scenes making this show happen. I'll be back again on Friday. Until then, enjoy the sounds of our theme song, I Guess Time Just Makes Fools of Us All, by Father John Misty.